Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is Veronica Monet, and it is Saturday, the 20th of June. My guest today is Francisco. He's calling in from Miami, Florida, and I understand that it's kind of muggy and there's mosquitoes everywhere. Francisco, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. It's just been raining a lot, so the sun's out and mosquitoes, so it's not the best Miami weather, but it's not too bad.
Yeah, well, you know, this is the rainy season for Miami, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it begins now and doesn't end until, like, mid-July, late July, so it's rain every day in the afternoons, basically.
I was there at the end of May last year, and I remember the thing that really just inspired me was those amazing thunderstorms that would move over the city of Miami. And I was staying with a friend in a high rise, so we were like up on the 70th floor or something, I don't know. And what a view of the thunder and lightning just going across Miami and across the bay there. So you guys do get some very dramatic weather.
Oh, yeah, it's nice. I've been out a couple of times in a boat too far, and then thunderstorms comes up. It's quite a sight for sure.
Now, are you out of college yet?
I'm in my last year of my BA at the moment, my BA in history, and I'm looking to go into my graduate program afterwards. But in the meantime, I'm just taking some classes in the summer.
And aren't you, so are you going to go right back into school in the fall, or are you taking off to do some Peace Corps work?
Yes, that is a plan. There is a anthropology program through Washington State University as a part of Peace Corps, of 2 years during Peace Corps.
Right.
I would be able to do a thesis on a master's thesis in anthropology. So that's one of my options I'm kind of looking at right now. That would be best case scenario. But even if that doesn't pan out, I'm also thinking of maybe simply just going to Peace Corps independently once I finish up my BA before I go into my graduate program. I see it as a great opportunity for me to kind of explore help people out and just learn. I think it's something I would really enjoy and something that would help me out in my futures and even in my job field, which I'd like to eventually teach into a university level.
Very, very cool. Now, you and I have been having conversations here. Just to kind of fill in our listeners here, we actually started off where I was consulting or coaching you around the dating scenarios that were going on
right.
in your life. And
right.
You actually got to a place where you felt feeling a lot more confident and a lot more focused on your own career, which is a great place to be at your age, so that you're not like feeling that desperate, I got to have somebody thing. And then, of course, that'll no doubt pull in a lot of people eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But today you kind of wanted to make a departure and talk about some of the, moral issues that our country is facing right now, and I think that's awesome because I love speaking at colleges and universities because this is where, the paradigms for the future are birthed,
mm-hmm.
is in minds that are still kind of fashioning their own value systems and not necessarily,
mm-hmm.
On board for whatever their parents or grandparents believed in.
Mm-hmm.
So the topic that you wanted to introduce today is, of course, a really hot topic here in the state of California,
mm-hmm.
and that is about gay marriage. And
right.
and I'm wondering, but before we actually get started into it, can you give us some sense of
mm-hmm.
what's kind of going on campus there in Miami? What do you find is kind of the pulse of the college-age students in Miami around gay marriage? Are they for it, against it, neutral?
Well, I think in Miami in general, there very much is a very acceptance of gay marriage, especially here in Miami, because I think it's very influenced by a lot of the gay culture here on South Beach, Miami Beach. So I think, like in any other kind of source of culture, there's a lot more communication and actually just learning allows for more acceptance. So I think Miami in general is very kind of liberal mentality towards gay marriage and for gay marriage, but I think this kind of tends towards to be a little more towards the youth. I think the older generations are a little more reluctant because they have a lot of strong Catholic backgrounds from very much Hispanic kind of cultures from Cuba and in Central South America. They tend to be a little more conservative in that sense, but I think even them, they're kind of slowly kind of more accepting toward, I think, a little more than the average state would be or area would be in the United States for the most part.
And I'm wondering, Florida doesn't have gay marriage, right?
No, at the moment, there's actually the last recent general election, they kind of reiterated what was supposed to be gay marriage or not, and it was actually shut down. So I think it was a setback for gays getting equal rights in Florida. But I think over time, I think we're going to have a social liberal trend in the state of Florida.
Huh. Well, you know, California had a battle out here with, we had Proposition 8, and the state was, you know, pretty bitterly divided on the topic. And Proposition 8 was going to make gay marriage against the law. And surprisingly enough, it passed. And we were all a little bit shocked because California usually tends to be the liberal state. And now you've got places like, Ohio and Illinois, I'm not sure, you know, that are passing laws saying gay marriage is okay. And these would be like, you know, the Corn Belt of America is making gay marriage illegal before California.
Right.
Kind of strange.
I looked a little bit into, like, the dynamics of the voting as far as when Proposition 8 came up. I think one of the key indicators was that a large portion of the black population had not voted for Proposition 8, against gay marriage. So there were a lot of skeptics saying that the gay rights activists weren't really appealing towards the black community within California, which essentially was kind of like the tipping of the iceberg as far as gay marriage. The problem is, I think since there is so much battle right now, I think a lot of people have kind of stepped back and take sides. So it's going to be a long time before any real consensus or kind of stability happens as far as this kind of like somewhat battlefront is kind of progressed into California. One of the big questions I wanted to bring up was, maybe as a solution to this battle of gay marriage or shouldn't we, is to eliminate marriage altogether as an institution of the state. I think there's a lot of benefits we would get as far as saving money as publicly, even on the individuals spend privately on divorce lawyers and prenuptial agreements. I think the benefits could be simply leveled out evenly, and because I don't think there's really any drastic benefit we gain from.
Let me see if I understand you correctly. You'd like to see civil arrangements, or you know, a civil marriage, if you will, where people.
No civil unions at all.
So how would you ascribe who your family is and who gets to visit you in the hospital or take possession of your property?
I think you can do that financially. You don't have to simply, you can have financial terms where you iterate who you'd like to have your money go to or who you want to consolidate your wealth with. I don't think this has to be a means of establishing, oh, this person is married to me, or because that starts encompassing moral dilemmas. I think we can separate the moral aspect, if it's right or wrong, completely from it, and still have a function of state where people consolidate wealth and put and choose whether or not to give wealth to other individuals. I think it's
I hear you, but frankly, I think it's kind of a naive stance. Marriage right now is mostly about money. It really
right.
has very little to do with morals or love. Marriage
right.
has always been a financial arrangement from the earliest,
right.
you know, inception
mm-hmm.
of the concept. This whole idea of it being romantic love kind of comes afterwards. But
right.
but there really are some very, very real barriers to people who don't have a legal claim to each other. There's no piece of paper or anything, or no law that says, this person is part of my family. Because
mm-hmm.
when it comes to things like power of attorney or being able mm-hmm. to make decisions about, you know, when should you unplug a loved one?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of medical care should they get? Being able to be in the hospital room with them,
right.
like beyond visiting hours, you know, like, okay, if visiting hours are over, but your, you know, spouse is very, very sick, they might like you spend the night in the room with them.
Mm-hmm.
Just this, there is an inexhaustible list of things that
right.
if you don't have some kind of legal arrangement between you and this other person, you are, the
right.
door is shut on you and you're not able to function as a family.
Correct. And I think that's why this aspect really encompasses so much, like you're saying, as far as those particular things that you mentioned. But I think we can still have those legal unions, but simply eliminate the portion whether it has to be a loved one you're supposed to be with for eternity. I think you can still have a person allowed to pick another person, any person they would like, to have those rights for them. It doesn't have to really necessarily be a marriage. You understand? I think I actually have the flexibility to pick
well,
a
that's
brother.
Why,
to
that's
do
why
that
right now they're giving gays, like in states that are banning marriage, but they
yeah.
are allowing civil unions.
Right.
So my question again was, are you envisioning a culture where we just ban marriage for everyone, not just gay people, but basically
right.
the government doesn't have anything to do with marriage,
yes.
whether you're gay or straight, and we adopt the civil union concept for everybody?
I think that would benefit us more. I think overall there would be a lot more, we'd actually save money because there won't be grounds for prenuptial agreements. And a lot of different things, aspects that we're still focusing on trying to part ways from a divorce. I think we would benefit more as society if we just simply had civil unions for anyone. And if you want to claim a marriage, I think this is more of a religious sacrament that religions have. I think if you're within your own culture and with your own people, I think you can have customs that allow you to pledge your lifelong of love for someone. I think that's fine, but I think as a state function, it's counterproductive.
Yeah, so it's in a lot of ways, you're kind of, I think what we're talking about here is separating out the monetary and legal definitions of marriage from
mm-hmm.
the religious, moral, and romantic definitions.
Yes.
So,
I think a lot of go on.
Yeah, well, so that we would take all, you know, the things that have to do with money and legal, you know, the legal things like power of attorney, you know, who's in the hospital and all that stuff, that goes with a civil union.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas it's actually interesting because Wikipedia says a civil union is a legally recognized union similar to marriage. And I guess the concept starts in Denmark in 1989, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it would seem that people are really hung up on the word marriage. I'm wondering, what does marriage mean to you? When you hear that word, what do you hear?
Oh man, it's myself. I was raised a Catholic, but very, very loose. And over time, I've kind of become more of agnostic. So marriage has kind of lost its really essence, what I initially kind of was taught, what it was supposed to be. like a lifelong pledge to be with someone eternally is supposed to be essentially an extension of you. That's kind of like the glorified religious kind of perspective we've kind of accustomed to learn. But as we see it in more reality, in reality of terms, that that it seems like humans aren't really built for this. That the high turnover rate of divorces and different things, and just how we seem to be naturally are, and we've seen in research and in past situations, it seems that the concept of marriage itself, it's a little flawed. But I think people are very much capable of living in monogamy and being happy with that. But I don't think it has to be a very bedrock of our society. I think we've supported marriage, we've supported family because we think that's the foundation of our whole entire society. But I think as we come to terms and we've liberalized much, I think this concept has been diluted away, that we don't really need to have this anymore.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, incidentally, this concept of civil unions that are open to opposite sex couples, they have those in Quebec and Uruguay and New Zealand. I love New Zealand. New Zealand's so progressive. They have decriminalized sex work there too. But so some countries have obviously started to say, "Hey, we'll just have one thing for everybody." But it looks like that they're in the minority. If there's only like three of them, and everybody else is still making this distinction, like, gay people can have civil unions, straight people get to get married. It kind of seems like it's saying, okay, we'll make sure gay people don't suffer here on earth, but the straight people are going to heaven.
I think that's why there's such a strong opposing this to gays having gay. They're very conservative for the gays to get married, because I think they see it. For them, it's a sin. I mean, and that's flat out dying. We're not going to change their perspective on that. So I think it's for them, it's allowing for perpetuative sin to continue on. So that's why they're so upfront about it. But I think this would be a kind of a middle ground. I think both sides can really, maybe possibly even agree on, because for them, they would see that their sacrament would be still held with purity, because it's separated from the state. No, if you're in a Protestant church, they're not going to allow you to have gay marriage unless certain ones do, but for the majority of them don't. But it allows, I think, somewhere of a middle ground, which would kind of alleviate the stress. And I think we'd be able to come to a consensus on and live in a kind of a much more stable environment, because battle lines of what is right, what is wrong, is simply, it's hurting a lot of people.
Well, by the way, there's a whole bunch of different words for this idea of a civil union. There's civil partnerships, registered partnerships, domestic partnerships, significant relationships, reciprocal beneficiary relationships, common law marriage, adult interdependent relationships.
It goes on and on and on.
Life partnerships, stable unions, civil solidarity pacts. I don't know who comes up with some of these things. But for gay marriage advocates, actually call this marriage apartheid, and feel that they are, kind of have an, to them it's the equal, a separate but equal myth, right? It's like, well, you can't eat in this restaurant or drink out of this water fountain, but don't worry, we're equal.
Right, yeah, it's kind of the separate but equal flawed concept. But my position would be that everyone would be equal, because marriage would be taken away from heterosexual couples, because so I kind of see this battle as two children fighting over the same candy. So, but instead of giving one candy to one side, you just take away the candy completely and kind of evened out. So I think both would be a little bit disgruntled that they're not getting what they initially fully wanted, but I think it's kind of a middle path where both sides can really agree on.
Well, yeah. So what do you think is that culturally, people seem to have so much emotion around marriage. It seems like it's a really emotional topic, and it's as if people are like really attached to the idea. And along that same line, how could you possibly take something away from somebody's marriage by allowing somebody else to get married? It seems like a strange concept to me, but this seems to be the big conflict, is that heterosexual people are afraid that if gays get to start getting married, if we allow gays to get married, then marriage won't mean anything anymore, or it won't be special, or somehow or another my marriage will, you're going to ruin marriage. I don't get it at all.
It's a broken concept. It's sad, but like I've seen prominent Republican politicians use this kind of somewhat same argument in the Congress. I mean, if we let gays get married, what's stopping people from marrying dogs? You mean, and marrying their chair? And I think it's just.
And I'd like to ask, like, why do people care so much about what other people are doing? I don't get it. Like, what business is it of yours?
I think we have to really kind of point at the Judeo kind of tradition culture that we've grown up in the United States. And the foundation of that is the abomination of Sodom and Gomorrah. Somehow that if we allow this perpetuating of sin to exacerbate it in society, it's somehow going to bring the whole society down and everyone with it. It's kind of one but all kind of concept. It's difficult. It kind of goes hand in hand with having opposing groups within your own society kind of breaks apart your own unity. I think it's kind of a subconscious fear and anxiety of what they don't really understand, and it kind of exacerbates when you constantly see it around you. So I think it's partially irrational emotion that's kind of pertaining towards this logic. Because obviously there's a difference between a human and a dog and a chair. And to make those kind of remarks is just simply enticing fear and enticing anxiety, which is not really constructive at all.
Well, I do think things are perhaps shifting culturally, however slowly they may be doing. It's really interesting to me. Yeah. I just recently did a little guest appearance on a local Fox News outlet, and they were talking about Ashley Madison, which is actually this website for couples who want to cheat. Now, it's not actually for couples. It'd be for people who want to cheat on their marital spouse, somebody that they married. So it's a website for straight people who want to cheat on their husband or wife. And the website costs a lot, but when you get in there, supposedly you're going to get a huge assortment of people who would like to have clandestine, discreet affairs, just like you presumably want to, so that you don't get caught. And they've done some surveys of late, which are showing that both men and women, the men a little more, the women a little less, but approximately 50% of men and women who are married will end up having an affair at some time during the marriage. So this idea of monogamy is actually pretty much a lie that is perpetuated by people keeping secrets and being dishonest. So when I was talking about this, I actually was saying, look, if you are cheating on your spouse, which means, and I don't mean just having sex outside the relationship, that could be something you arranged with your partner. But if cheating suggests that they don't know and you're taking something away from them. And I consider that a form of theft. It's like, this person did not agree to have that type of a relationship with you. But what I was really excited about was that at the end, they're asking me, well, what's the solution? And I said, well, maybe some of the people who are cheating are actually polyamorous. Maybe they aren't really wired for monogamy, and they would do better in a relationship that's open, And I said, and that would be a great solution for their dilemma, as long as they, get the tools to learn how to communicate those needs and boundaries and respectful limits within the context of that relationship. So each partner can do that. But anyway, they actually broadcast that, which it didn't make it to the cutting room floor, was like, oh, wow, I can't believe that. You know, polyamory and open marriage was the last words uttered in this little documentary. I just go, wow, amazing.
Yeah, it's we see the more you're really involved in the understanding of marriage and how it's really seems like it's unnatural for humans to kind of exhibit for the most part over and over and over again as we learn more about it, it becomes more open. The thing is that there's just still so much social pressure to be in that monogamous kind of relationship. So people that may want to even exhibit those, to believe, live a kind of polyamorous kind of lifestyle, will kind of step back and shun away from just on the fear of how other people would perceive them. I think this kind of perpetuates this feeling of jealousy, and the power of jealousy to kind of convey that you actually show that you actually care. If you're not jealous, you're not really caring. So this kind of is so much intertwined with marriage and self-perception and the perception of others onto yourself. Is very, very strong. So if you go to the workplace or you go to your family, not many people have the kind of the strong will. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm polyamorous. And like, what? What does that mean? For most people, they don't really have that self-confidence to do that. So they'd rather just simply live in a monogamous relationship and cheat, which ultimately leads to more kind of a worsening of their own lives because lying and doing the whole act of trying to hide the fact that you're having sex with someone else, for most people, it's kind of it eats away at them. I mean, I think most people want to have trusting relationships where they can do those things, but it's difficult.
You know, one of the great ironies, I think, is that, like, for instance, when you teach abstinence only in the public school system, what you produce is a lot of unwanted teen pregnancies.
Oh, yeah.
That's the results. So it really doesn't matter what you think. You know, you may think that I should be able to drive, you know, with myself blindfolded and get my car to where it's going, but you're not gonna. I mean, you have to understand the laws of reality. And the reality is that if you teach teenage kids that abstinence is the only way, the teen pregnancy rate goes up. And that's the legacy that we have thanks to the Bush administration. We have got a teen pregnancy rate that is out of control. And of course, Sarah Palin's daughter is a fabulous role model for exactly what abstinence-only teaching brings. It brings teen pregnancies.
Right.
So, you know, hopefully we get that through our thick heads now, that if you want fewer unwanted, unplanned pregnancies, teach people how to use condoms. And you know, the Pope just recently said that condoms don't work. That is just the biggest load of bull that anybody has spoken recently. They absolutely do work. They work not only to prevent pregnancies, but they work to prevent the spread of STIs, sexually transmitted infections. So it's kind of similar in that fashion. I think when we have compulsory monogamy, that the end result of compulsory monogamy is infidelity. And infidelity is a lot different than an open marriage or polyamory, because what you have is betrayal. You've got, you know, broken hearts, people who feel like their very health was taken out of their own hands. They don't get to decide who they get exposed to sexually because their partner's gone out and had sex with whomever and however they wanted with no regard for their health. And that's what compulsory monogamy seems to produce. It produces infidelity. But if you can allow people to be self-determining to where, you know, and you know, the same thing actually with, you know, we make it impossible for gay people to have a legitimized romantic family experience. And when we do that, we also force a certain sector of the gay population to stay in the closet, to marry heterosexually. Mm-hmm. And so then that also creates these very frustrating, empty relationships where somebody is in the closet, self-hating, and, you know, their partner feels betrayed years and years later when they finally come out and say, well, I was gay the whole time, but, you know, the culture doesn't support it, so I was afraid. I think it would be awesome if we could finally start giving human beings choice. You know, these are adults. Let's trust them to run their own lives, at least when it comes to the bedroom, you know?
Something is kind of perpetuating this, I think it's this whole concept of hate sin, hate not the sinner. So on an individual basis, they might not particularly hate them, but when it comes to legislation, when it comes to bigger issues, allowing them, people that claim to be gay, but more rights or equal rights, they automatically try to do whatever it takes to end it. I think the real way to really progress the society is to have a very, very drastic investment into education. I think majority of these problems is really the lack of understanding. The people that are perpetuating or pushing the ideas, like you're saying, of abstinence is the only way, are really people that actually have the lowest education. People even that are conservative that are not particular, that are actually in that have higher education, most of them will likely agree to, yeah, it might not be right, but we need to at least give them condoms. Abstinence really is not a legitimate way of controlling teen pregnancy. So I think the best way to really progress the society, even though it's baby steps in the right direction, is education. And sadly, where it seems like education is slowly dwindling and falling apart, astronomical high school dropout rates, I think this perpetuates very flawed kind of mentalities. Another kind of topic I wanted to talk about is related to so much of the misconception whether or not even if gays are a choice or if you're born that way. I think this is at the bedrock of this problem. And it's sad a lot of even very intelligent people don't say, oh, there's no gays in other animals, and that's just false. I mean, there is a homosexuality in other species.
There is so much gay and lesbian sex going on in the animal kingdom that it's not even funny. I mean, ducks, for instance, ducks and geese routinely form lesbian and gay couples. And it's actually with the lesbian couples, they have the capacity to build a nest and lay eggs. The eggs just aren't fertilized, so that their eggs never hatch, but they actually live together just like a heterosexual couple would.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I mean, you know, of course the bonobos are pansexual. They have every kind of sex you could possibly imagine having. And, you know, it's bisexual, gay, lesbian, whatever. I remember the first time I saw an animal engaging in homosexual sex. It was my own cat having sex with another male cat. And I was, you know, raised in a very right-wing Christian home. So I was just horrified. And, of course, because of my training, I thought that the devil made my cat do that.
Right.
And so, you know, it was incumbent upon me to put an end to it, and I ended up kicking the cat because I found, you know, the whole mentality was, I must find this to be an abomination, and I must say an emphatic no to this evil, because my mortal, you know, soul is hanging in the balance here. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think a lot of people have, you know, they've got this deep, seated religious views about right and wrong, where it becomes the only way you can rebuke evil is by minding your brother's business.
Right. And I think the reason why religions, not only Christian religions, but most of the major religions have sexual repression as a core of their beliefs, is because it allows for a religion to kind of manipulate and kind of control people. I think there's a very strong aspect of that. So the religion that had this as a premise were able to gather more people and to perpetuate over and evolve over time. Every single one, from Islam, Christianity, to even a lot of Buddhism, where you have to extract this, remove yourself from sex. So this allows for people to be manipulated by religion. So I think it's more of a controlling and power aspect why these religions have adopted this mentality. But in this, it's shown that it's productive for our society. It really hurts us, not makes us any better. It doesn't make us any less violent or any other way.
Right. Oftentimes, a lot of wars and violence is perpetrated in the name of religion, really.
Right.
But so, speaking about, you know, I know we've had this conversation before about nature versus nurture, and I've told you that I tend to think that nurture has so much to do with the human animal and how it responds, because, you know, you can take just about anybody and put them in a different environment, and they are going to respond more in line with the environment they grew up in.
Correct.
But then that really does beg the question, if that's true, that we are taught and raised and our environment shapes us, then what some of the conservatives say about gay and lesbians is that they have chosen that, and that it's not, you know, a genetic predisposition, or if it is, that they should at least find the willpower to fight it off.
Correct.
So, what do you think? Do you think that you know, one's gender orientation is something that your environment shapes, or do you think it's something that you're born with?
Well, I don't think I think there's actually a little mixture of both. I mean, on the one extreme end, one can say, oh, you don't choose your hair color, per se. Or, and the other opposite end, you don't you're not genetically predisposed to like the color blue. And I think it's like the polar opposite. From my opinion, it seems like that people have a very strong genetic predisposition for their sexual orientation. I think there's a lot of biological chemicals that affect our feelings and our sexuality. I think that has to have a strong genetic component. But on the flip side, I think there has to be some a small nurturing aspect for homosexuality, or just genetic orientation in general. I think we, for the most part, we socialize heterosexuality because it's very prominent forte in our society. But I think because there's a little more nowadays, there's a little more outspokenness about it. I think there's people that are maybe on the kind of that gray zone would gravitate towards more of a homosexuality life, because it is being a little more openly accepted. So I think to read in my statement a little clearly, is I think there's predominantly a genetic component, but there has to be a small nurturing aspect. So what is your opinion on this?
Well, my personal experience as somebody who considers themselves bisexual is that it was something I was born with. I have a very strong recollection of being 9 years old, and there was this 7-year-old girl who used to come over to play, and when she was talking, I was so distracted by what I considered her beauty that I really wouldn't hear anything she said. I would just sit there and nod and smile, you know. But the whole time, I'm 9 years old. I don't even know that sex exists, so I wasn't having sexual thoughts or anything of the kind. It was very much puppy love kind of thing, very sweet, very innocent. It was just that I was distracted by her hair color and the color of her eyes and the color of her skin. You know, I would get lost in her physicality. It was intoxicating to me, but I didn't understand it. I didn't even know gay people or lesbian people existed, so I sure didn't think that I was sexually attracted to her. I thought I was just, you know, making an observation that anybody would have noticed. But I also had this little feeling of discomfort that my preoccupation with her skin and her hair and her eyes was maybe not quote-unquote normal and not like most other people of my gender. So there was a sense that I better keep how I feel a secret. And by the time I got to college, which was, you know, 10 years later at the age of 18, then I found it very difficult to concentrate when I was in the bathroom. You know, we had the showers in our dormitories. So we had the showers. There'd be like 20 showers in the bathroom. And so women were running around in towels and doing whatever they do in front of the mirror. And I constantly was looking down, trying not to look at anybody because I knew that they were going to be able to see that I was sexually attracted to them. And I was terrified, absolutely terrified somebody would find out that I, again, wasn't normal. And then rumors would spread, and none of my girlfriends would let me into their dorm rooms anymore just to visit, you know, that I'd somehow or another get blacklisted. So when I think about how uncomfortable all of that was, how scary it was, and how early in my life it, you know, originates, it feels like it's part of my physiological makeup and not something that I certainly would have signed up for willingly. I didn't know anybody who was bisexual. I didn't have any peers. I had nobody to, you know, like encourage me into it. Instead, it was more like these forces inside of myself that I was trying to run away from.
Right. But let's say, could it be possible that for someone that might have maybe be bisexual, but through culture, kind of did like what you were saying, kind of somewhat suppressed it, but over time, really suppressed it so much that it's kind of almost turned into a repelling force, and would that essentially iterate a complete nurturing aspect of sexual orientation, or that suppression can never lead towards like an actual not feeling for the opposite sex. That's just
Not sure I understand what your question is. It sounds like you're musing about the idea that somebody would have a negative experience being associated with the gay world and move away from it.
Well, my question is that because someone's taught to be not to be bisexual, not to be homosexual, at a very young age, even though you might have a genetic predisposed for that.
Uh-huh.
But over time, they kind of somewhat really become simply heterosexual. That even though they initially might have had those bisexual tendencies, because of kind of suppression, could you essentially really eliminate that, just feelings completely? Because that would kind of iterate a nurturing aspect that our society has the power to really manipulate our sexuality, at least to some degree.
Well, you know, it hasn't been my experience. I've been working with, especially men, with their sexuality now for the last 20 years. And I got to say, my experience has been a lot of guilt and shame and sorrow and you know, twisted, perverted. I consider these twisted, perverted attempts to circumvent one's own natural inclinations. So, you know, while the churches may call homosexuality a perversion, I call the church's stance on homosexuality a perversion. And I think it's horrific what happens to people and how they cannot accept themselves. They cannot love themselves. They try to force themselves into these unnatural boxes that don't fit them at all, and they try to be somebody that they're not in order, you know, to hopefully not feel all this guilt and shame.
Right.
But it festers, and it never does go away. It's not like it can be eliminated. And sooner or later it will rear its ugly head. And frankly, I think a lot of the homophobia that we see is perpetrated by closeted homosexuals.
Yeah.
People who have a lot of self-hatred and are so terrified of this deep, dark secret inside themselves that the only way they can feel any kind of relief from that is to go out and punish other people for expressing what they have no courage to express themselves.
Yeah, there's been a very few infamous cases where, like you were saying, very prominent, outspoken people within the church, even without that, are for the longest time condoning homosexuality, and then 5 years later they're caught with homosexual prostitutes, or they were someone comes out and says, oh yeah, he was just homosexual this whole time. You mean that does happen. You mean, and it shows you the religion, like you're saying, the very darkest side of society really shunning away from homosexuality. You have people really going on a psychological fringe and living such a duality of life that's self-destructive.
Well, speaking of duality, one of the things I think we do ourselves a real disservice is constantly telling people you've got to choose. You're either straight or gay. And also you have to choose for your lifetime, right? Now, while I'm convinced that nobody would intentionally sign up for the level of disruption that having a gay or lesbian or a bisexual identity can really create a lot of disruption in your life because the culture's not friendly to it. And I don't think that unless you are, you know, just kind of a rebel and you want to piss people off, and I actually probably have met a few people who, you know, call themselves lesbian or gay just because they like the political alliance.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it has so many repercussions that are negative that nobody's going to go do that just for the fun of it. So I tend to think that it is a genetic or a biological construct.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that it's kind of interesting that I think that sometimes people will kind of get into what's popular in the moment. So, for instance, this whole bisexual girl thing that's going on right now, I think that is a cultural thing. I think there's a lot of girls out there that are kissing other girls, you know, a la Katy Perry, I kissed a girl and I liked it. who are not really bisexual. They're just goofing off. They're doing it because they want to pose, you know, or kind of, you know, shock their friends, be different, that kind of thing. But
yeah, it's a bad word, but yeah, it's a kind of recent phenomenon of like pop culture of doing that. But you have a weird kind of blur. Like, I see, like, for instance, you have women that like to be with other women that look like men, though. And that's not necessarily kind of like the same. I don't know. It's kind of getting these weird kind of blur zone between homosexuality and heterosexuality. I mean, they're kissing a girl, but it looks like a guy, but it's really a girl. But they're doing it for kind of this pop culture kind of phenomenon. So it's an expression of that. We slowly are progressing because something like this would have never happened, even let's say even within 20 years ago. So I think this is.
I have to say something about the looks like a guy thing, okay?
Right.
I'm the kind of girl who likes to wear makeup and I like to wear high heels. But
okay.
I don't think that makes me look like a girl. I think girls, I always tell people, if you really want to see what a girl looks like, go to the Castro in San Francisco. You'll see women have hair on their upper lip, and they have hair under their arms, they got hair on their legs, and they really don't look that much different than guys. And that's a real girl. What we have called real women, you know, and we call it feminine, that's drag in my book. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, yeah, I'm a lot of times I feel like a butch in drag. I'm a woman mm-hmm. who's got kind of a more masculine personality, but I absolutely show up looking feminine by this culture standards. So I call that drag, you know, this is my drag. But that's not what women aren't born with lipstick and high heels.
They're
not born absent body hair. They're born with lots of hair.
Right. You know what? It's the problem with gender profiling. I mean, we have this society has a mentality what a woman's supposed to look like and what a man's supposed to look like. But we see now that it's become such of a weird gray zone because the gender profiling really doesn't fit what the actuality of truth. You mean like you're saying women.
And in actual fact, we look very similar. And when you go, basically from, you know, like age 15 to 50, we do look different. Women tend to have, you know, more curves and men tend to have more angular bodies. But interestingly enough, as before puberty and in old age, men and women look very much alike.
Right. It's when the hormones kick in and we divulge and become very sexually active is when we have that difference. But once we lose that, it kind of goes back to normal. So,
right, but we have secondary sex characteristics for, you know, our procreative years. But you know, really seriously, look at some of those old pictures from the 1800s when they were first settled in the West, and you can't hardly tell the men from the women except for that one
That's
of them wearing a dress.
That's very true.
The women got big bushy eyebrows and no makeup, you know, and they all look like dykes. I would argue that they all look like dykes because dykes look like real women.
And you know what? I think that's actually like you're mentioning how you point to like an older example is because I think this is more of a recent phenomenon because if you go back a little further in history, people really didn't have the means to really to dress up and to have so much gender profiling as you would 200 years ago or even further back than that. Now, since we have the means to do this, I think we've had this drastic shift in appearance is because of the anxiety of homosexuality and just trying to promote monogamy. So I think we've had this recent trend because we had, I think society has just divulged the capability of doing so. But
I don't know. You know what I think the ultimate irony would be? That probably women's fashions all came from gay men in the first. So the only reason that we have all of this stuff that makes us quote unquote look like society says women look like nowadays, which is not what women really look like, is because gay men made it possible.
it's hard to talk because we're
about out of time here, so. I'm going to have to wrap this up. As always, it's so much fun to talk to you.
Same here. I've always enjoyed it. I learned a lot. And hopefully, like the listeners are listening in also.
I learned a lot from you too, and I especially loved some of the conversations we've had about, you know, some of the more gentle ways that one can start having conversations between disparate political camps, and I think that's really what the future needs. I really do. So maybe that would be a good thing for us to talk next time you're on. We could actually talk about, you know, how we can build those bridges between people who disagree with each other.
Sounds like a plan. I'll start doing the think tank for it.
Awesome. Well, I know if anybody can do it, you can. I think you have more strength in that area than I do because I'm like a debater. So can we talk again in maybe 3 or 4 weeks?
Sounds good.
All right. You're going to still be in the country, right? You're not taking off for our summer break?
I'll still be in the country. Actually, I'm taking summer classes right now, awesome. Starting next week. So I'll be studying hard, but also hopefully I'll be looking forward to the next radio show.
All right, sweetheart. I hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend, and thank you so much for joining me today in the Shame-Free Zone.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian.